All right, so this is Bio 241, and it is November 17th, Monday. That means that Wednesday is your test, the 19th. So you got a test coming up next time. What chapters is that on? 10, 11, and 12. That's right, 10, 11, and 12, and that's it. So we're going to finish up 12 today. And so that's all good news. I have a scholarship announcement right here. I don't know if it's really going to pertain to this class, but this scholarship is a national scholarship. I think there's probably 20 or 30 that are parceled out over the United States. It's $7,500 a year. Usually it's going for 2 years, so it's a lot of money. But it's for people in science, engineering, and math. You guys are in science. But your aspirations would have to be in a career in science, like maybe doing research or something, and not medicine. And I don't know if that pertains to anybody in this class. Okay. So if you're interested in education or clinical applications, this this scholarship is not for you. But for instance, if you're thinking about going on for a PhD specifically, not for teaching, but for doing research, then this scholarship would be aimed for you. So is anybody thinking along those lines, a career along those lines at all in here? No, this is a Goldwater scholarship. But if you know anybody that's in science, engineering, and math that wants to proceed along those lines, let them know about this scholarship, because it certainly is worth a lot of money. Okay. And then the other thing, too, is I got a call from the SI office just a little while ago saying that Lynn is not going to hold an SI session today. And I don't know if she usually holds it on Mondays or not. So if anybody was planning on going to SI, it's not going to happen today. So if you're curious about whether it might happen tomorrow or before the test, maybe you could give her an email and find out. Okay? All right, so those are just some announcements. Oh, the other announcement is, too, if anybody might become interested in being an SI leader for this class, for springtime, you should let me know and let Lynn Selden know, and it's a paid position. I forget how much you can make a month, but it's $8.50 starting, $13.50 per hour as you move your way up, and I don't know how many hours you can get a week, maybe 10, maybe even 20, I'm not sure. So if anybody's interested in being a collaborative learning leader for this class, let me know. Okay? All right. All right, that's it for announcements. So you got a test coming up. Is there any questions? Anybody have any questions? New questions? Fantastic. Yes. So let me make sure I write it down. 12.8. I'm not sure. I don't want to write it down unless we're really sure. It's a sarcomere, right? It's a picture of the sarcomere that has the A-band, I-band, the M-line, Z-disc, actin, myosin, that kind of stuff. So if you can label that one, you can label the other one. But I will try to... Yeah, because it's the same bands in there. But you know what? I'll try and get it on the internet tonight. Okay. Yeah, you should be able to interpret which goes where. All right, so we were talking about contraction in skeletal muscle. And, oh, by the way, what is the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle? What's that called? That's the sarcomere, right. So that's why that figure is important, because it shows you the structure of a sarcomere. So what are some of the main proteins in a sarcomere? Actin is one. Myosin is the other. Those are the two most important. The titin acts passively to return a stretched muscle back to its resting length. All right, but actin and myosin are most important for shortening the sarcomere with tension, with force. So which one of those shorten when the sarcomere shortens? Which one of those proteins, either the actin or myosin, which one shorten? Neither shorten. That's right. Don't be tricked by that question ever. Neither of them shorten. Why? How would you describe shortening of a sarcomere if none of those proteins actually can shorten? They do what? They slide. It's called the sliding filament mechanism, right? So the figure that I have up on the screen right now just shows the energetics of how the filaments slide over each other. So don't forget we have this cross bridge. There's the head group and the tail group, and the cross and the head group has got an ATP binding site, and it's got an actin binding site. And the head group can articulate with the tail group. Okay, you can see it like in a flexed position over here, an extended position over here. And the power stroke is defined as when this head group actually flexes. Okay, and when the power stroke is initiated when inorganic phosphate is released from the head group. All right, so let's start here. So actin and myosin aren't associated with each other at this step. ATP binds right to the head group at the binding site, and as long as tropomyosin is moved out of the way, because calcium binds to, what's the molecule that calcium binds to? It's the short one. Troponin. Okay, tropomyosin moves out of the way, and that reveals the binding sites for the actin binding site right here on the head group of myosin. All right, so when ATP binds, that causes the release of the head group from actin. All right, so it's not associated with it. Then ATP is hydrolyzed. And when ATP is hydrolyzed, that releases energy. That energy goes into extending the head group. You see it nice and extended up over here? Once it is extended, it can now bind to an active site on the actin, which we see right here. All right, so hydrolysis of ATP causes the extension of the cross bridge, then it can bind to the actin. And when that inorganic phosphate is released, goes through the power stroke. And when ATP binds to the ATP binding site, it releases from the actin to get to this position right here. So what do we have? The model is, for instance, if my right hand is a myosin molecule with a cross bridge in my finger, okay, in the very top diagram, we see that the myosin head group is extended. That requires ATP to extend. After it extends, it can bind to the actin molecule. When inorganic phosphate is released, what happens? The head group goes flexes, and look what happens to my hand when the head group flexes. My hand actually moves. Right, it slides over the myosin molecule. When ADP is released and ATP is bound once again, then the myosin head group releases from the actin. And when ATP is hydrolyzed, the head group extends again, right, reaches up, and that cycle is repeated over and over and over again. So the filaments just slide past each other, just like that. Okay, so don't forget the power stroke is when the, not when ATP is hydrolyzed, but when inorganic phosphate is released. Okay, when ATP is hydrolyzed, that's when the head group moves from a flexed position to an extended position over here. Okay, and the other thing probably that's important to recognize with this cycling right here, when is the head group released from an actin molecule? What has to happen before myosin can release from actin? Where is that? Here it's bound, here it's released. What's the difference between this state here and this state here? ATP, binding of ATP. All right, so just the binding of ATP is necessary to unlock the myosin head group from the actin. Okay, so that's how we would explain rigor in most circumstances. All right, when ATP is depleted in a cell, when the cell is in the process of dying or is dead, then calcium leaks out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It binds to troponin, moves tropomyosin out of the way, so myosin can bind to actin. And as ATP is being used up, right, muscles contract, and then the muscle is in a contracted position, and all the ATP is used up inside the cell, and myosin can't release from actin that produces that rigor mortis state. Okay. All right, so we talked about all this and excitation, contraction, coupling, the different kinds of receptors. Okay. All right, so I think we're right about at this level in our discussion. A single rapid contraction and relaxation of a muscle is called a twitch, which we see right here. Actually, I see two twitches right here. All right, so this is a plot of tension versus time. So we're not looking at action potentials, we're actually looking at force that's generated when a muscle is stimulated into contracting. And we can actually measure that tension. And if a second stimulus, so we don't see the stimulus on this graph, this just shows the tension that's developed. So here's the first twitch, reaches a maximum, and it starts to go back down to zero. But if before it reaches zero, we stimulate that muscle to contract again, what can you tell me about the height of the second contraction? It's higher, right? Okay, so this is what we call summation. So if a second or third or even fourth or fifth stimulus is produced before the first contraction has completely relaxed, right, the subsequent contraction will be at a higher tension. And so this just shows, right, summation taking place, and if we leave a sufficiently fast stimulating sufficiently spaced, closely spaced stimuli in time, we can see that the muscle contraction gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and it reaches a plateau region right here. So that's the maximum amount of tension that could ever be produced by this muscle. This is what we call incomplete tetanus, because you can see the muscle actually is relaxing between these intervals of stimulation. The second graph right over here shows complete tetanus, so that the rate of stimulation is sufficient so that the muscle never ever relaxes, but there still is a maximum of contraction that can take place. So we call this complete tetanus or tetany. And a muscle can't stay in this state for a long period of time, okay? And so even though the rate of contraction or the rate of stimulation is the same or faster, right, the muscle eventually is going to lose its ability to contract, right? So the tension is going to decrease even though the muscle is being stimulated, and we call that fatigue. And what could fatigue be due to? So we're directly stimulating this muscle. We're not working through the neuromuscular junction at all, so it's not the neuromuscular junction that's fatiguing. This is the actual muscle that is fatiguing. So more than likely it's due to lack of ATP, because when this muscle is contracted, blood can't get into that muscle, and oxygen can't be given to mitochondria. Mitochondria aren't making ATP, and that ATP is necessary. Plus there are other biochemical changes. Lactic acid is being produced, so the pH of the muscle changes, and the muscle gets weaker as a result of changes in pH. Okay, so let's talk about three different ways that we can characterize muscle contraction. Isotonic contraction means, so iso just means staying the same, and tonic means tension. All right, so an isotonic contraction means the force remains constant throughout the shortening process, but the length changes. So for instance, when your hand is open like this and you flex your fingers, all right, like so, is the length of those muscles changing as your fingers are moving, flexing? Yeah, the muscles are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and that's causing the articulation of your digits. Now what about tension? Is tension changing when you do that? You know what? It's not changing very much, because there's nothing resisting that motion at all. So this is what we call an isotonic contraction. So the tension is remaining constant, but the length of those muscles are changing. That's an isotonic contraction. Isometric contraction, on the other hand, is that the exerted force does not cause the load to move. So the tension remains the same, but the tension is increasing, but the length of the fibers remains the same. So a good example of that, say you have a walnut that you want to eat, but it's in the shell. What do you got to do to eat the walnut? You got to crack the shell open somehow. Okay? So put a walnut in my hand, and then I use an isotonic contraction to form my fingers around the walnut. And when I touch the walnut, in order to break it, what do I got to do? I got to squeeze it real hard. So if I squeeze it real hard, is my hand changing conformation at all? Are the muscles shortening? Are my fingers moving at all when I'm squeezing on that walnut? Harder and harder and harder. My fingers aren't moving, but what about the tension? It's going up. Okay? So that would be an example of an isometric contraction. When I have a walnut and I squeeze down on it harder and harder and harder and harder until finally it cracks open, okay, and then I can open up my hand and eat the walnut. So isometric means the muscle length is not changing, but the tension could be increasing. And the third kind of contraction is what we call an eccentric contraction, or a lengthening contraction. And this occurs when the load is greater than the exerted force. So if the load that's trying to stretch the muscle is greater than the amount of tension that the muscle is producing, then the muscle is going to stretch even though it's contracting. And we produce motions like that all the time. For instance, when we walk down the stairs, right, we use muscles to keep us from falling down the stairs, but nonetheless, they are still lengthening even though we're contracting them so that we don't fall down the stairs. And this is actually kind of the most damaging kind of exercise to have a muscle go through. So I don't know if any of you have done any hiking or walking around up in the hills or mountains or anything, but in terms of a cardiovascular event, it's harder on your heart and your lungs to walk up a hill and down, but in terms of your muscles, it's actually harder to walk down a hill than it is to walk up because of these eccentric contractions. All right, so don't forget there's that series elastic component in both tendons and muscles, the connective tissue, are elastic and absorb tension that the muscle, as the muscle contracts. They recoil as muscle relaxes and springs back to its original resting length, along with that tightened molecule. Okay, so here's a pretty important topic in the chapter, and that is the length-tension relationship in muscle. And you have to relate to this via a model of a sarcomere. All right, so in order for a sarcomere to contract, what two proteins have to interact with each other? The actin and the myosin, okay? And so there's a cross bridge on myosin that has to be able to bind to an actin molecule. So there has to be overlap of actin and myosin molecules. If there's no overlap, right, then the filaments can't slide past each other. So that's one important thing to pay attention to. So the strength of muscle contraction is influenced by, of course, the frequency of stimulation. All right, so we notice that in summation, and the faster we stimulate a muscle, that means the more residual calcium we have left over in the myofibril, which means what, there are more active sites on the actin molecule for myosin to bind to, right? And it takes time to pump all that calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And the second thing is that the thickness of each muscle fiber, the thicker the muscle fiber, that means more myofibrils are in that cell, so the tension is greater. So the thickness of the muscle fiber is directly related to the strength of muscle contraction just because of the number of myofibrils. And then the third thing, which we have to look at, is that the initial length of the muscle fiber is related to the strength of muscle contraction. So there is an ideal resting length that which can generate the maximum force. So let's look and see how this can be understood. So here is a plot of relative tension versus percent resting length of a muscle. So this means when the muscle is very short, right, 60% of its rest length, that this muscle can't generate any tension. So this means what? That the muscle is not stretched at all. It's actually already contracted. It's already shortened a little bit. It can't develop tension. And when the muscle is way stretched out, it can't generate tension either. So let's see how we can explain that from our understanding of a sarcomere. Well, this first case over here, all right, notice that the sarcomere is already shortened, and that the distance from Z-line to Z-line pretty much encompasses the whole length of myosin already. So even if cross bridges were to cycle, okay, these Z-discs can't be pulled any closer because there's no room in the sarcomere for these Z-discs to move any closer to the M-line. They're already butting up against the end of the myosin proteins. So the Z-lines can't come any closer together. Okay, so now let's stretch the sarcomere. So we stretched it. This is before it contracts. All right, so now look at all this distance right here that this sarcomere can shorten, right, before it runs out of room for shortening. This produces the maximum amount of tension. And then, if we further stretch the sarcomere, notice that we've stretched the sarcomere so much that there is no longer any overlap between the actin and myosin. And so now the myosin head groups, even though maybe they want to, they're allowed to bind to actin, and maybe tropomyosin is moved out of the way, but there's no myosin head group in this area to bind to an actin molecule. And because of that, then the actin and myosin can't slide over each other. So there is an optimal overlap, okay, whereby it produces the maximum amount of tension. So actin and myosin have to overlap to develop tension, but the overlap can't be too great because then the sarcomere can't shorten. If the sarcomere is stretched too much, then there is no overlap between the actin and myosin to develop any tension. Okay, let's talk about the neural control of skeletal muscles. So the motor neuron cell bodies, remembering our anatomy, is in the ventral horn of the spinal cord. Axons leave the ventral root, right? That's the motor root. And they're called the lower motor neurons. The upper motor neurons come from the cerebral cortex, but the lower motor neurons leave the spinal cord and go to skeletal muscle. And sometimes we call that the final common pathway. And activity is influenced by sensory feedback from both muscles and tendons. It can be facilitatory or inhibitory activity from the upper motor neurons as well. All right, so higher centers can affect the lower motor neurons. To control skeletal muscle movements, nervous system must always be getting information from sensory apparatuses in the tendons and the muscles. All right, so the proprioceptors in muscles are what we call spindle apparatus, or muscle spindles. Muscle spindles can measure tension and measure length of a resting muscle. And there are other organs called Golgi tendon organs that send tension information to the central nervous system. So let's look at a couple of these. All right, so Golgi tendon organs are in tendons. We'll look secondarily at how those work in just a moment, but let's talk about a muscle spindle apparatus. So here we have a muscle spindle. You can't ever really see it in the muscle because it's microscopic, but we have thousands of these in all of our skeletal muscles, and it consists of modified muscle cells called intrafusal fibers. So the normal muscles that are used for contraction are what we call extrafusal fibers, but the muscles inside the spindle apparatus, which can shorten, they don't shorten by developing tension, they just shorten by changing their length, but not tension, these are what we call the intrafusal fibers. So if we zoom into this area here, I see this and this one, and this one are intrafusal fibers. But these, with nicely demarcated sarcomeres, these are the extrafusal fibers. So these are the muscles that contract with tension. So this is the muscle spindle apparatus. All right. From the muscle spindle apparatus, there are nerve endings that send information to the central nervous system. So we call these the primary and secondary sensory fibers. Then there are other motor neurons that go to this system. The ones that go to the extrafusal fibers, we call these the alpha motor neurons. Then we have nerve fibers that go to the spindle muscles themselves, and we call that the gamma motor neurons. So we got gamma motor neurons going to the intrafusal fibers, and we got the alpha going to the extrafusal fibers. All right, the intrafusal fibers have nuclei right in the center of the muscle. And you can, that's signified by these blue dots right here. And we see that there are two different kinds of arrangement of nuclei. This is what we call a nuclear bag fiber, because they're just a random arrangement of nuclei in the center of this fiber. But these other fibers have the nuclei lined up like a chain. So these are what we call the nuclear chain fibers. And these are in the intrafusal fibers, but not the extrafusal fibers. Okay, so here are sensory nerves. So this is what we call the annulospiral sensory organ in the nuclear bag fiber. Right? And these fibers wrap around the central regions of the nuclear bag fiber, and these respond most to the onset of stretch. So these send action potentials, which the frequency of which is directly related to the onset of stretch, but not continual stretch. Right? The other kind of nerve fibers, nerve endings that we have, are what we call flower spray endings. And the flower spray endings are in the nuclear chain fibers. These respond to sustained stretch. So even this information is useful for maintaining posture when you're not moving. Both the nuclear bag and the chain fibers respond strongly to sudden and rapid stress. Right, so they both respond the same way to that, very strongly. And their activation causes reflex contraction of the muscle that they're embedded in. Okay, so the fast-conducting alpha motor neurons innervate the extrafusal fibers, which are the common fibers that you're familiar with, and cause the muscle to contract. So the muscle is going to shorten, right? The slower conducting gamma motor neurons innervate and induce tension in the intrafusal fibers. Right, so the intrafusal fibers, before they start to contract, have a certain length. Okay, and they're embedded within the extrafusal fibers. So if the extrafusal fibers, I guess maybe just kind of follow my fingers. If the extrafusal fibers were to start to shorten, okay, and it would shorten the spindle apparatus, the tension within the spindle apparatus would disappear. Okay, so if the length of the muscles in the spindle apparatus stayed the same length, but the muscles around them shortened, right, that would decrease the tension inside the intrafusal fibers. And so it's the job of these gamma motor neurons right here to take up the slack of the intrafusal fibers. So when the extrafusal fibers contract, that produces tension within the muscle spindle apparatus. And that increases the sensitivity of muscle to passive stretch, because your body wants to protect itself from passively stretching these muscles out. Okay, so both the alpha and gamma motor neurons are stimulated together. We call that coactivation. The upper motor neurons usually stimulate the alpha and the gamma motor neurons simultaneously. We call that coactivation. Stimulation of the alphas result in muscle contraction and shortening, and that would normally cause the intrafusal fibers to lose tension. All right, but since the gamma motor neurons stimulate at the same time, that causes the intrafusal fibers to take up slack. And the activity of the gammas maintains normal muscle tone. So let's see how this works. The monosynaptic stretch reflex consists of only one synapse within the central nervous system that we see right here. So here is the nice quadriceps muscle, and it's connected to the patella via the patellar tendon, and then the patella is connected to the tibial tuberosity via the patellar ligament. We can stretch the patellar ligament by hitting it with a hammer, right? And that's going to pull on the patella, and then the patella is going to pull on the patellar tendon, and that's going to pull on the rectus femoris muscle. That's going to stretch the extrafusal fibers, but because of coactivation, that's also going to stretch the muscle spindle apparatus. Right? If the muscle spindle apparatus wasn't coactivated, it would be too loose, so this muscle, when it's stretched, it wouldn't activate the muscle spindle apparatus. But since the muscle spindle apparatus stretches, that sends action potentials, right, up the sensory neuron. So here's that sensory neuron, into the spinal cord. So this is just a nice sensory pathway where it synapses directly on the nerve cell body of the lower motor neuron. And that sends a signal out the ventral root, which is going to contract the extrafusal fibers, thereby protecting this joint from stretching. And that's what we call the knee-jerk reflex. That's just a monosynaptic reflex. And that's because of the muscle spindle apparatus. Okay, Golgi tendon receptors act a little bit differently. They require two synapses. So we call this a disynaptic reflex. The sensory axons from the Golgi tendon apparatus, or Golgi tendon organ, right, is right here. So when the muscle produces a lot of tension, that increases the frequency of action potentials via the sensory neuron, and it comes into the gray matter of the spinal cord, synapses on an interneuron, so this stimulates the interneuron, but the interneuron releases inhibitory neurotransmitter on the alpha motor neuron going to the extrafusal fibers. All right, so this is going to decrease the action potentials going to the skeletal muscle. And what's going to be the effect on the skeletal muscle? So what's going to be the effect when this interneuron is stimulated? Is this an excitatory interneuron or inhibitory interneuron? It's inhibitory. So what is that going to do to the contraction of the skeletal muscle? Is it going to inhibit it or stimulate it? Okay, it's actually going to inhibit. So this muscle is contracting. For instance, let me give you a little scenario. Maybe I want to give you some lecture notes and say your eyes are closed. So you don't really know how many lecture notes I'm going to give you. You might think that it's maybe 20 or 30 pages. But maybe it's lecture notes from 5 years of college, hundreds of pages. So what's going to be heavier, just a couple pages or like all 1,000 pages of lecture notes? Yeah, really, really heavy if it's like years of lecture notes. All right, so I give that to you and you take it. Okay, so what happens to the tension in all your tendons in your arms trying to hold up that heavy weight? The tension rises very, very quickly, right? And if you try to hold on to it, that could actually damage that tendon or that insertion, right? It could actually pull off of a bone. So this Golgi tendon organ right here is going to protect your musculoskeletal system, all right? So as the tension increases, it sends a high frequency of action potentials to the interneuron. The interneuron is going to release a lot of inhibitory neurotransmitter. That's going to inhibit action potentials going down to this muscle. And what's going to happen? The muscle is going to relax as a result of that, and you're going to drop that heavy weight. So that's going to protect your body from sudden increases in weight, which might actually rip this tendon right out of the insertion in that particular bone. So that's the Golgi tendon organ reflex. It prevents excessive muscle contraction or even passive muscle stretching as well. All right, so this makes, that's due to the inhibitory synapses of motor neurons right here. All right, so if we inhibit this motor neuron, that's going to cause this muscle to relax, right? Okay, cardiac and smooth muscle. So what kind of muscle does this look like here? Okay, how do you know that's cardiac muscle? Because intercalated disc, number one, it's branched, number two, and it is also striated. Okay, so striations are characteristics of both cardiac and skeletal muscle. So cardiac muscle, well, skeletal muscle has striations. So what does that mean about the internal structure of skeletal muscle? What is it made up of? It's made up of, what's the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle? A sarcomere, right? And that produces striations. So if you see another kind of muscle that has striations, you can say, oh, well, that's because it's made up of sarcomeres, right? The arrangement of actin and myosin overlapping each other. And on one end, there's a Z-disc, and on the other end, there's a Z-disc. So cardiac muscle shares some similarities with skeletal muscle that way because it is made up of sarcomeres. It is striated. And it has troponin and tropomyosin too. So excitation-contraction coupling works the same way in cardiac muscle as it does with skeletal muscle. Okay. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that we don't have any neuromuscular junctions on the heart like we do in skeletal muscle. So remember that for every muscle cell to contract, it has to be stimulated by a motor neuron, right, an alpha motor neuron, but not so with cardiac. And that's because the connection between cells, the way that cardiac muscle cells communicate with each other, is not through a chemical synapse, but through an electrical synapse, right? And the electrical synapse is placed within the intercalated disc. So one of the components of an intercalated disc are these gap junctions. And the gap junctions allow sodium to move directly from one cell to a neighboring cell. So for instance, if this cell depolarizes, the top right-hand corner depolarizes, that sodium current moves into the cell over here on the left. And what is influx of sodium going to do to the cell on the left? It's going to depolarize it, right? So that's going to initiate excitation-contraction coupling in the second cell, right? And because cardiac muscle is branched, not only does that excitation move laterally up and down the heart, but it can also move between different layers within the heart. And that's because the cell is branched. So let's say we depolarize the cell way over here on the left. What's that going to do to the cell? So let's say this cell depolarizes. What's going to happen to this cell right here? It's going to depolarize because there's this gap junction, and that depolarization is going to move into this cell. But what else is going to happen? That depolarization moves down to the next deeper layer, and then even the next deeper layer, right? Because these cells are branched, which then causes what to happen in this cell right here? Depolarization, right? So it doesn't just cause parallel waves of depolarization, but it causes depolarization through the whole thickness of the heart as well, because these muscle cells aren't fibers, they're branched cells, okay, because of those gap junctions. So those gap junctions allow action potentials to spread throughout the whole myocardium, which is the muscle layer with inside the heart. Okay, so that's pretty good for cardiac muscle. Smooth muscle, on the other hand, so here we're looking at some smooth muscle, and here's a micrograph of some smooth muscle. Do you see striations up over here? No striations. So the arrangement of actin and myosin is totally different compared to cardiac and to skeletal muscle. It really doesn't have the classical sarcomere arrangement. It does have actin and myosin, but it's just a little bit different arrangement. So let's look at this. It's kind of what, like an elongated football-shaped cell. Okay, so we can see myosin. These are the dark filaments, and here is actin, the thin filaments. So it's this is the myosin in the middle, actin on the ends. But instead of being attached to Z-disc, they're attached to special locations on the cell membrane that we call dense bodies. So we don't have a Z-line moving all the way across the cell. We just have one little point on the cell membrane, which is what we call a dense body. And when the cell is stimulated into contracting, the actin and myosin slide over each other, like in a regular skeletal muscle, but it doesn't pull the Z-discs closer together. It pulls this dense body closer to this dense body over here, which is on the surface of the cell membrane. Okay, so when that happens, all of the dense bodies in the smooth muscle cell get pulled closer together, so the cell just kind of scrunches up as a result of that. So it doesn't really shorten from end to end, but it also kind of shortens from side to side as well. So here is the arrangement. Okay, these myosin groups right here are different. They're packed more closely together, and there is no troponin and no tropomyosin in smooth muscle. So I want to show you kind of a nice model of how smooth muscle contracts. So let's just say that this is a smooth muscle cell right here. Sort of doesn't have the right shape because it's spherical, but just kind of stretch it out, just kind of pretend. So here we have some actin and myosin molecules attached to these points on the surface of the cell. So there's nothing deep inside the cell, it's just on the cell membrane. What do we call these points that anchor actin? These are the dense bodies. So when a smooth muscle contracts, what happens to these dense bodies? They just get closer together, right? So there's nothing that's changing the length. All these dense bodies are closer together. So when this smooth muscle cell gets activated into contracting, right, the dense bodies just get closer together and the whole length of the cell shortens as a result. And when actin and myosin relax, right, the muscle cell gets bigger. Right, and when it's told to contract again, then the dense bodies get pulled closer together. So this is really how smooth muscle contracts as opposed to how skeletal muscle contracts. Because of the dense bodies. All right, so how do we control smooth muscle contraction? It's controlled like calcium, but it's much different compared to striated muscle. Smooth muscle has almost no sarcoplasmic reticulum. So in skeletal muscle, what is the job of the sarcoplasmic reticulum? It's a calcium storage. And then, if there's an action potential on the sarcolemma, the sarcoplasmic reticulum releases calcium into the myofibril for skeletal muscle. But since smooth muscle has no sarcoplasmic reticulum, it can't be used for allowing calcium to associate with the actin molecules. Right? And again, there is no troponin or tropomyosin in smooth muscle either. The way that calcium enters is through channels in the plasma membrane. So when an action potential or when a smooth muscle cell depolarizes, then calcium channels open and it allows calcium to enter the cell directly from the extracellular space. So calcium is high outside a smooth muscle cell compared to the inside of the smooth muscle cell in a resting condition. And in skeletal muscle, what does calcium bind to? In skeletal muscle, calcium is released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum and it binds to troponin, which moves tropomyosin out of the way, so actin and myosin can associate with each other. But in smooth muscle, since there's no troponin, calcium binds to its cousin, calmodulin. You've heard of calmodulin before. All right, so the activated calmodulin complex activates a myosin light chain kinase. All right, so myosin what? Is the part that forms these cross bridges that reach up from myosin to actin. And there are light chains that make up that cross bridge. And as opposed to what kind of chain? Light chain is one kind. What's another kind of chain? There's a heavy chain. Okay, so it's not light and dark in this particular case, but this group has a heavy part and a light part, and the light part, right, can be activated. All right, so the part that activates this, the light part of the myosin is called myosin light chain kinase. All right, so what is a kinase enzyme again? It's going to add a phosphate. All right, and what's it going to add a phosphate to? This myosin, right? But it's what? Not the whole thing, just the light part of it, the light subunit. All right, so that phosphorylates and activates myosin. So as soon as this myosin has been phosphorylated, that's when the cross bridges can start this cycle. All right, so it doesn't need for tropomyosin to get out of the way. It just requires myosin to be phosphorylated. When myosin is phosphorylated, then it can hydrolyze ATP. So then the myosin can form cross bridges with actin once it is phosphorylated. All right, so relaxation occurs when calcium concentration decreases. So how does that calcium concentration decrease? What's active in the cell membrane all the time that's working? So don't forget, calcium is high outside the cell, it's low inside the cell. So how does calcium get outside the cell? How does something go from low concentration to high concentration? It's active transport, and that's usually a pump, right? So the calcium pumps are always pumping calcium outside the cell, causing the muscle to relax. But when the muscle cell is stimulated, it lets a lot of calcium rush inside the cell that overwhelms the pumps, and the muscle starts to contract. And as the signal for contraction disappears, then the pumps take over, pump calcium outside of the cell, and the muscle relaxes once again. All right, so myosin is dephosphorylated by myosin phosphatase. So myosin phosphatase is always active inside the cell. And as a result, myosin can no longer form cross bridges, and the smooth muscle starts to relax. And so this process takes a little bit longer to accomplish. So smooth muscle contracts much more slowly than striated muscle. So the excitation-contraction coupling just takes a lot longer because of all those enzymatic steps necessary for it to proceed. But one of the nice things about smooth muscle is that it can form a latched state. So smooth muscle can stay contracted for very long periods of time without requiring a lot of ATP as a result. So that maintains force while using very little energy. So who could tell me of contraction of smooth muscle that might last for months? And it's a good thing it doesn't require a lot of energy, for instance, like skeletal muscle. How about during gestation, right? When the cervix has to be contracted to maintain that pregnancy. That cervix never gets a chance to relax like a skeletal muscle, okay, because it's made out of smooth muscle that can get into a latch state and stay contracted. Okay, so let's look at this diagram right here. So here we have a plot of membrane potential versus time of a smooth muscle. So just like the heart shows autorhythmicity, we haven't talked about this yet, but the heart does not need innervation to contract. It can contract on its own. There are nerves that go to the heart, and the nerves that go to the heart just adjust the rate and force of contraction, but it can't. It's not necessary to maintain any kind of rhythm inside the heart. The same thing is kind of true for some skeletal muscles. So we can see that this skeletal muscle right here spontaneously, what's happening as this membrane potential goes from negative to positive. This is depolarization. So smooth muscle can spontaneously depolarize. And maybe what's the best way to think of spontaneous depolarization? What's happening? There's sodium channels that are leaking sodium all the time. Okay, so this spontaneously depolarizes. And then the next time, it depolarizes to a little bit higher degree. And then the next time, it depolarizes even more and it reaches threshold, which then stimulates action potentials in this particular smooth muscle, which is going to cause the smooth muscle to contract. All right, so when an action potential flows over the cell surface of a smooth muscle, it triggers voltage-gated calcium channels, and it causes them to open. So what happens to calcium? Where is calcium high? It's high outside the cell. So when the cell depolarizes, calcium can enter the cell. And when it enters the cell, it can bind to calmodulin. So not troponin in this case, but calmodulin. So here is an activation complex, calmodulin-calcium complex. Then dephosphorylates myosin light chain kinase. When it's phosphorylated, it's in an inactive form. When it's dephosphorylated, myosin light chain kinase is active. But this is what? An enzyme. Myosin light chain kinase is an enzyme that wants to do what to something? What does a kinase want to do? It wants to put a phosphate on something. It wants to take ATP and another protein and phosphorylate it. Right? So a kinase phosphorylates something. So it finds myosin, and in particular the light chain of this myosin group, and it phosphorylates it. So it converts that myosin from an inactive form to an active form that can form cross bridges with actin in a smooth muscle cell. So this activates cross bridge formation, and when cross bridges are able to form, right, this myosin can hydrolyze ATP and it can cause sliding of myofilaments. What happens to a smooth muscle cell when the myofilaments slide past each other? The smooth muscle cell contracts, right? The dense bodies come closer together as a result of that. Okay, so there's nothing ever protecting the binding sites on actin. It's only when the myosin chain, this light chain, is phosphorylated that it can cross-bridge cycle. Okay, so now how do we cause smooth muscle to relax? Well, calcium is pumped out of the cell with a calcium pump. And when calcium is pumped out of the cell, calmodulin-calcium complex dissociates, and then myosin light chain kinase becomes phosphorylated once again, and it becomes inactive. And also in the cell is myosin phosphatase. This is always working to dephosphorylate myosin. And when it does, it becomes inactive once again and the muscle starts to relax as a result. Okay, so myosin phosphatase is converted between an active and inactive form by phosphorylation as well. So dephosphorylation of cross bridges leads to relaxation. So that's a different kind of scenario than what we've seen with skeletal muscle, right? The myosin in skeletal muscle doesn't have to be phosphorylated to become active. The only thing required is that calcium has to bind to troponin to get tropomyosin out of the way. So smooth muscle can take a couple of different forms depending on how it operates. So there is something called single unit, and there's something called multi-unit. Single unit smooth muscle is spontaneously active. We say it's myogenic. Some cells are pacemaker cells, just like we have some pacemaker cells in the heart. So for instance, this would be an example of a pacemaker cell. It just depolarizes spontaneously and in a rhythmic manner. And when it reaches threshold, that causes that smooth muscle to contract. And single unit has gap junctions. So what's the beauty of a gap junction again? A gap junction allows all the cells within that tissue to depolarize when, what? When one cell depolarizes. So it allows that sodium current to move from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next, throughout that whole smooth muscle unit. Multi-unit requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system and neurotransmitters released along a series of synapses called varicosities. And sometimes we call those varicosities synapses en passant, or synapses in passing. It forms a little string of pearls. So on this slide, we see single-unit smooth muscle versus multi-unit smooth muscle. Single-unit, for instance, in the digestive tract. For instance, if we have an autonomic neuron, and this we can tell is an autonomic neuron. How can we tell this is an autonomic neuron right here? Because it has varicosities instead of synaptic or axon terminals, right? So each one of these varicosities contain synaptic vesicles. So when an action potential moves down this axon, neurotransmitter is released from each of these varicosities right here, which then bind to ligand-gated channels on the smooth muscle, which causes depolarization. And look at the connection between these neighboring smooth muscle cells. Like this thing right here. What does that look like? That looks like a gap junction, so that depolarization can move directly from one cell to another, causing the neighboring cells to depolarize. And when they depolarize, what happens to all these cells? They all contract pretty much as what? A single unit. So this is what we call single unit smooth muscle. Okay, as opposed to multi-unit smooth muscle. So here we have multi-unit smooth muscle. Do you see any gap junctions right here? No. So each cell has to be stimulated by binding a particular neurotransmitter. Right, so in this particular case, you know, this could be, one could be sympathetic neuron, the other could be a parasympathetic neuron, one could be stimulatory and the other could be inhibitory, or these both could be stimulatory neurons. And so when each of these varicosities releases neurotransmitter, it binds to a ligand-gated channel, which causes just this one cell to contract. Right, which is independent of signals from any of these other cells in the multi-unit smooth muscle. So in order to contract this whole muscle, all of these motor neurons have to be activated, not just one, as we have seen in single-unit smooth muscle here. Okay, so that's it for the test. And I think this is an exam figure. Right here. So who's got a question on this one? Anybody have a question on this one? Okay. You know, when it says light chain right here, there's a lot of ways that we can separate proteins out. And you actually did a lab on this. When you did a diffusion experiment, right, you were able to watch diffusion of two different molecules. One was kind of red, I think, and one was kind of blue, or one was brownish. You know, I'm not really big on color. And the other was kind of blue or purple or something. One was able to move faster. Which one was able to move faster by diffusion? Okay. Yeah, it was one of the colors. I don't remember which color. But what was the physical property other than the color? It was by the molecular weight. Molecular weight is the size of the molecule, right? So the smaller the molecule, the faster it moved, the heavier, the slower it moved. So it's very easy to separate molecules by their size. And so people took muscle, smooth muscle, ground it up, and they got molecules that move fast. Those are the light ones or the heavy ones. Those are the light ones. And the molecules that move slowly are the heavy ones. And they found out that it's the light ones that become phosphorylated. So that's how they call this the light myosin chain as opposed to the heavy myosin chain. And so they named this enzyme that phosphorylates it myosin light chain kinase. And when myosin is phosphorylated, what happens when myosin light chain is phosphorylated? When the light chain of myosin as opposed to the heavy chain? what happens to smooth muscle when the light chain is phosphorylated? It contracts, okay? So, and that's all regulated by this calmodulin activated complex when it's bound to calcium. So calcium acts as that extracellular signal for smooth muscle contraction. Okay. So, questions? Yeah.
I was wondering if we need to know anything about the flow of back switch fibers.
I don't think we have any of that on the test. Yep. Unless there's a question at the end of the chapter or something, but I don't think I assigned any specifically on those. Yeah. Any other questions? No? Okay. Well, let's see. What's next? Cardiovascular, I think. Let's just kind of check and see what might be next here. Blood, heart, and circulation. Okay. Well, what are the functions of this circulatory system? Well, it plays a role in transportation of respiratory gases. Like, who could name a couple gases that might be important for moving around inside your body? Oxygen that we inhale. So it's a job of our cardiovascular system to transport oxygen to all our cells, because what organelle needs oxygen? Mitochondria need oxygen. Okay, what's the purpose of that oxygen in mitochondria? What's it doing? It's accepting electrons, right? Making water out of it, and as those electrons flow through the electron transport chain, that generates a lot of ATP via that chemiosmotic theory. Okay, so that's very important. And in the process, the Krebs cycle produces CO2. We need to get rid of that from our bodies. So that also helps removing CO2 from our bodies. Delivery of nutrients. Like, what kind of nutrient would you think is good to distribute through your whole body? Glucose, exactly right. Okay, and hormones. What kind of hormones help in glucose metabolism? Insulin and glucagon, for instance, right? And waste removal. Okay, like the breakdown products of blood have to be, of red blood cells have to be removed. All right, the blood also functions in temperature regulation, because if there's a part of your body, for instance, muscles, when they're exercising, they generate a lot of heat, and we are isothermic organisms. That means that we maintain our body temperature at 98.6, and if a muscle gets much hotter than that, blood flows into that muscle, removes the heat, and takes it to another part of your body so that you can expel that heat from your body. So heat transfer is real important, or temperature regulation. Another function of the blood is that, I got a question. What kind of tissue is blood? Connective. That's right. Remember, there's four kinds of tissues. You got what? Epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. Blood is a kind of connective tissue, because it connects all your body together. So, but blood is an interesting kind of connective tissue, because it's a fluid. It's a fluid connective tissue. So if you damage your body or damage a blood vessel, what happens to that fluid? It's just going to run out of a blood vessel. So an important function of blood is to prevent blood loss or blood clotting. So that maintains that connective tissue. And the last function of the circulatory system is that it has an important immune function. So it helps fight infections and prevent disease states due to infections. So, okay. So the components of the circulatory system include the cardiovascular system and the lymphatic system. The heart pumps blood through the cardiovascular system. Blood vessels carry blood from the heart to cells and then back again. So this includes all the tubes like arteries. What's the definition of an artery? Anybody remember the definition of an artery? It takes blood where? Away from the heart. Away from the heart. Okay. To a capillary. And an arteriole is just a small artery. And then what's the function of a vein? It takes blood to the heart. from a capillary, right, back to the heart. And what's the function of a capillary? That's where exchange takes place. And exchange can't take place in an artery, can't take place in a vein. Why is it that exchange can only take place in a capillary but not an artery or a vein? It's a really simple reason, and that's because capillaries are very, very thin. So diffusion can take place through a very thin membrane, but arteries and veins have many layers, including connective tissue, elastic tissue, and muscle, and so diffusion cannot take place through these thick vessels right here. So if there's something in blood, it has to stay in the blood until it reaches a capillary, and then it can leave. Right? And so fluid leaves capillaries, and that fluid would have a tendency to build up in various parts of our body, but there's another system that takes that tissue fluid and returns it back to the cardiovascular system, and that's the lymphatic system. So the lymphatic system picks up excess fluid, filtered out of capillary beds, and returns it to the veins, and in particular the subclavian veins. Where are the subclavian veins at? Yeah, up over here. They're underneath your clavicle, so they're called subclavian veins. And as that excess tissue fluid enters a lymphatic vessel, we call it lymph, and lymph has to be processed on its way back to the cardiovascular system or that subclavian vein, and it's processed by lymph nodes, which are part of the immune system. So lymph nodes help fight infections when there are bacteria in lymph nodes. Okay, so blood, the connective tissue, has two main components to it. There's a fluid component and a cellular component. So this is pretty much what whole blood looks like. We see, what are these cells right here? These little donut-shaped cells. What's another name for a red blood cell? Erythrocyte, because erythro means red, cyte means cell. All right, so these are the cells that carry oxygen in our bodies. And they're red because they're loaded with a chemical compound called hemoglobin. And hemoglobin has an iron molecule in it, and that gives the red blood cells a red color when it binds oxygen. And when we look in a red blood cell, we don't see any organelles. We don't see a nucleus. We don't see mitochondria, for instance. So they're kind of an atypical cell because even though they're alive, they contain cytoplasm, they don't contain a nucleus. So they don't live for very long. They only live for about 120 days or so because they don't have that nucleus. Another kind of cell are these right here. They don't contain iron, and so they look just kind of like a regular cell, and underneath the microscope they kind of look a cream color or a whitish color or beige. So we call these white blood cells. What's another name for a white blood cell? Leukocyte. So leuko means white in Latin. It's always... For instance, what's the symbol of the United States, the animal symbol of the United States, that big bird? Yeah, eagle. What kind of eagle? The bald eagle, because he has a whole bunch of white feathers on his head. That's the only place that has all the white feathers. So his scientific name is leucocephalus. What does leucocephalus mean? Leuco means white, cephalus means head. It just means great white-headed bird. Okay, that's the Latin name for the bald eagle. So don't forget leucocyte. All right, and another kind of cell are these guys right here. Oh, I didn't tell you the function of white blood cells. They help fight infection. That's their job. They're part of the immune system. And these cells right here are called platelets. But what's another name for a platelet? Another name for a platelet. Here we got, this is erythrocyte, which is this one here, leukocyte, and these over here. This is what we call a thrombocyte. These are the things that help prevent blood loss, are the platelets. So platelets, red blood cells, white blood cells make up the part of blood that we call formed elements, right? Because these platelets are really cell fragments. They're not really cells, but they're a formed element. So these all make up the part of blood we call formed elements. And what else is in blood besides formed elements? The plasma, that's the fluid part of blood. So the plasma is the fluid part of blood. That contains everything that could be dissolved in blood, like sugar and different kinds of proteins are dissolved in blood or the plasma. All right, so sometimes we want to quantify what is the percentage of formed elements in whole blood. And we do that by taking a blood sample from somebody and putting it in a test tube and let it sit overnight. And then all the heavy stuff is going to fall to the bottom of the tube, namely what? The formed elements. Or if you don't want to wait overnight, you can put that in a centrifuge and spin it so all the heavy stuff goes down to the bottom of the tube. And what's left on the top of the tube? Just the plasma, all the light stuff, as opposed to what? The heavy stuff, like in the light myosin chain, okay? So this is how you separate heavy things out from light things. And in this particular case, this is a way that we measure a quantity that's called hematocrit. Hematocrit is the percentage of formed elements, the cellular part, in whole blood, which includes what? Formed elements and the plasma. So, what would be the hematocrit of this sample right here? What would be? Does this look like it's about half? Or a little bit less than half? A little bit less than half. So, a good hematocrit would be maybe 45% for women, a little bit higher for men, maybe 47% for men. And that's just how we determine hematocrit. So, hematocrit would be, if we take whole blood, which would be 100%, all right, so, and then measure how much volume for formed elements and divide the volume of formed elements by the volume of whole blood, that would be the hematocrit. And that tells us if we have about the right number of cells in whole blood. Your total blood volume is about 5 liters. Plasma's straw-colored liquid consisted mostly of water and some dissolved solutes. These include ions. Give me an important ion that we might have in blood. Sodium is a good guess. What else is another good one? Before you took this class, probably you didn't really think of it. What's another kind of ion in blood that has to be regulated? Oh, I think I heard somebody say calcium. Absolutely. Probably before you took this class, you thought calcium was important for bones, but it's probably even more important to have calcium in your tissue fluid so that you can have what? Synaptic transmission and muscle contraction, right? Metabolites like glucose, hormones like insulin and glucagon, as well as antibodies. And these are the protein components of plasma. Erythrocytes compose most of the formed elements. And the percent of red blood cells in centrifuged blood sample, that's what we call hematocrit. And that's about 45% or so for women, and a little bit higher, maybe 47% in men. Okay. Plasma proteins comprise about almost 10% of plasma. And there are 3 kinds of proteins. There are albumins, there are globulins, and fibrinogen. All right, let's start with fibrinogen down over here. Fibrinogen is a soluble protein, but it can be activated, it can be converted into fibrin very quickly, and fibrin is insoluble in blood. So it forms a precipitate. And this is important because it serves as a clotting factor. So when a blood vessel is damaged, cut open, fibrinogen is converted to fibrin, it precipitates out, and it forms like a bandage on the inside of the blood vessel, closing the clot off so blood can't leak out. All right, so blood clotting is due to fibrin formation. And another word for clotting is called coagulation. Okay, the other important thing about this term right here is whenever you see a word with an O-gen on the end of it, that means that it is an inactive molecule. Fibrinogen is inactive. What is the active form of fibrinogen? It's fibrin. Right, and there is an enzyme that converts fibrinogen into fibrin when a blood vessel is damaged. We're going to look at that mechanism in a little bit. Oxygen. Okay, so there's a little Y in there. Well, we can always find some exceptions to that rule, and we can kind of just chuckle at them. But we do have to use some, you know, just some common sense in the context in which we read these words. Another way that we signify something is inactive, right? So if there's ogen, it's inactive at the end of a word. Sometimes we put a prefix at the beginning of a word, right? So for instance, prothrombin, right? So ogen right here means it's inactive. Thrombin is the active enzyme. Prothrombin means it's inactive. Okay, so prothrombin, so if you ever see a pro at the beginning of a word, right, that might mean it's inactive, but the exception to that is what? Protein. Okay, there's a pro right here, but that doesn't mean that it's inactive, right? So there are exceptions to that rule. Okay, so I think next time, a week from today, we're going to start, make a note in your notes, we're going to start here with plasma proteins. Okay?
I didn't go to this class.